Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and currently Joel's on assignment trying to find the perfect ramen recipe. So we kind of sent him abroad to Japan. He'll be back for the Throne Blood episode. No, wait, I'm getting stuff mixed up.
The Throne of Turtle Blood episode.
yeah, the voice you just heard is Martin Kessler. He was on the Descadent episode. That was a real fun time. Also, his favorite Kurosawa movie.
I'm never going to live it down.
Yeah, so, hey, welcome back.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me on, especially to talk about such a delicious film.
Right, so without a pun. Okay.
Yeah, I think it was.
I mean, this... I'll confess now, this is the first time I'd ever seen Tampopo. I'd heard of it. It's kind of through like this doing this podcast and being into Japanese film. It's something I was aware of, but I didn't realize one, how big it was in, like, internationally. And I watched it when I was hungry, which was not the best thing to do.
I knew ahead of time I had to bring in, like, bowls of soup to eat while I watched the movie. It's impossible for me to get through without eating, I think. And, yeah, I guess I'd known about it before ever seeing it. It just has kind of this reputation. I think, like you said, more internationally. It might have been Nobuko Miyamoto, who played Tempopo, talking, she said it wasn't really that successful in Japan.
I mean, it swept the Japanese Academy Awards, basically.
I guess maybe she said it was a bigger hit internationally. She might have meant more financially. Yeah, I'm not sure, but it seems like, I guess abroad, everyone seemed to like it. I don't know anyone who dislikes this film, so it's a pretty fun, charming,
yeah, it's
movie. It's got a lot of heart. It's about food. It's very relatable. It's unpretentious. Like, it's just such a good movie. I'm excited to talk about
it.
Yeah,
I was when I sent you the list of what was still available, did you pick Tampopo because it was the last good thing to you, or is there like you have like a special association with this?
I think it's just such a breezy film. I felt like there was a lot to talk about as soon as I saw, oh, that's an option. I thought that's something I can talk about and that would be fun to discuss because, like, it's got the main plot and it's got the little short plots and it's about food. Everyone can talk about food, right? So, I think it's a great film, but... you know, there's one or two films I think were on that list where it's like, I'm sure there's somebody out there who could be on the show who's more qualified to talk about that film than I am.
Are you referring to Maradayo?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, well, the right people came on for that. That was a fun episode. Kurosawa's last movie, so there's kind of a weird melancholy attached to that one, too.
Yeah, I mean, there's things I like about it, but it's like, on one hand, kind of a minor movie, but like on the other... there's certain things going on that you sort of feel like, you know, maybe you should know a lot about Kurosawa's biography or, you know, it's like one of those films where you sort of feel like you maybe need to bring a lot to it.
Oh yeah. I'm not trying to get into it too much, but, a big difference between Tampopo and Maradayo is that Maradayo is about a specific famous professor/writer
right.
in Japan who, if you grew up in Japan at a certain time and of a certain duration, you would know exactly who he is and you would get all the references and like all the little like story beats within the movie, but it kind of requires a lot of previous knowledge to fully appreciate, where Tampopo, you can just jump right in and enjoy it.
Exactly. Yeah, I think, I mean, the first scene in Tempopo where you're in the movie theater and you have that guy in the suit who kind of looks like a gangster or, you know, just like a classic Hollywood type character, the way he's dressed, talking about how annoying it is to eat crunchy food in the theater. Like, it kind of immediately makes the film accessible, and you kind of know what you're watching, and he goes over and tells off the guy eating the crunchy chips or whatever it was. It kind of puts you in the mood right away, even before the main story begins.
My initial reaction was, oh, this is going to be like the pornographers with like a weird meta wraparound. And then there is no... continue to see him, but it's not like a wraparound like with the pornographers and the whole, like the... I think they're editing the movie or something.
I think like at the end, it cuts to them. It cuts to an audience
watching
the film.
Yeah, and it opens with...
And they're sort of commenting on it.
It opens with people and then ends with people talking about how shitty the movie was.
Yeah, let's go watch something else. That movie was weird. Yeah,
yeah. And this was, I was thinking, oh, is this going to be like Emma Mora thing? Like, oh, no, it's just, but I had seen other Itami movies, so it's kind of like, oh, this is, Esther probably realized this is just his kind of kooky, weird charm.
Yeah, I mean, they almost feel like, you know, skits you might see, like, not Monty Python necessarily, but, yeah. You know, these like little comedy kind of cutaway jokes in between the main story. And sometimes you have recurring characters like that guy in the suit. Other times it's just a sort of one-off with two characters you never see again. And it's just a funny idea. And it's all related through food. And you sort of feel like you get the full range of human experience, death, birth, high class, low class through these vignettes. And the story kind of keeps it all together and gives it some kind of a backbone, so you don't feel like you're just watching one scene after another. But
on film comment on their Deep Focus column 2 years ago, someone did the Deep Focus on Tampopo, and they bring up I haven't seen any Buñuel movies, but I know enough about Buñuel to pick up on like some of his key things, like this movie definitely is inspired by him in certain ways, like with the young businessman with the older businessman like thing, and right. Like the whole thing with food and class. And apparently Itami, he was directly inspired by, what is it called, I think Phantom of Liberty.
I could see that. I mean, there's a Flixwise Buñuel episode coming up very soon. You know, there's some similarities you could sort of see in the structure of, I don't know, for instance, Milky Way, where you have kind of this main plot with these two guys going along the pilgrimage, but it kind of uses that to weave in and out of these skits. Or, I could see a Buñuel influence, actually.
Yeah, the art.
The sense of humor, the storytelling.
Yeah, and it also brings up one was the discreet charms of the
discreet charms of the bourgeoisie. The discreet charm of the bougie folks. To me, the film doesn't feel so much like a attack on class, Tampopo, but it does kind of undercut some of the pretentious attitudes maybe that people have surrounding food in certain scenes, like probably mostly that scene with the spaghetti, which I'd forgotten until I just rewatched it yesterday. But it's such a funny scene talking about the how taboo it is to like slurp your spaghetti, and you shouldn't make any noise, and you know, it's like you have to keep it classy and etiquette. It's like some kind of an etiquette lesson. Meanwhile, there's this Western guy sitting right across from them, just like slurping away in his spaghetti. And then all the ladies at this spaghetti lesson look over, and then they just see it's okay and start slurping their spaghetti. I mean, that's not so much like an attack on class as it is on etiquette, I guess.
Yeah,
that's more what that scene's about. And just like this.
And that ties into the whole thing of slurping the ramen noodles, like it's tied thematically fits, and you know, a little bit, it's not key, but it just adds a little
sure. I mean, that scene partly too, I think, it kind of makes fun of this idea that you might have of another culture. Like, you have these preconceived notions that, oh, it must be very strict or taboo to do these things. And just like the vast majority of people don't care about any of those sorts of things. You know, you always hear like before you travel to another country, like, oh, you should do this this way and do that that way. And, oh, this is very rude. And you go there and it's like people breaking all the rules you heard, and you realize, oh yeah, people don't care, that's not important, all that stuff. Like, people are people wherever you go. So I that's a very funny scene. And I think the business men scene, it's right next to it, right? They're kind of flow from one into the other. And
that's when I realized, oh, I'm gonna love this movie. It's just
that's such a good
so
scene.
funny, like when I think the fourth guy orders the same thing, I just couldn't handle it and I just started laughing out loud.
You
And then like
just realize what they're setting up. Well, like, I mean, the whole it's even funnier when you rewatch it, because you see them all sitting around looking at these menus, but they're really no one wants to order before the big boss does. It's like, ah, like I'm not really hungry right now. Why don't you order first? So they see what he orders. I forget what his title is, but he's obviously the guy in charge. And after that, they just sort of spin their wheels, but they're all ordering exactly the same thing: the sole with the no soup, or with soup and no salad and a beer. And it's just the same with every guy. And then you get to that last young guy who actually knows his stuff. Like he just sort of. Oh, you make it like a sausage-shaped quenelles, and the waiter says, "Yeah, it's our chef trained at that place that you ate at." Like, you realize he actually knows it, and oh, I'll have a wine. Like, is there something from this year? And you just see them all red in the face. It's so funny, and the kicking him under the table is great. Like, that's such a well-done comedy scene. I mean, like, it's a pretty lighthearted movie. There's one or two moments which. Like do kind of get more into something a little bit not darker, but like more substantial with some of the emotional stuff. But a lot of it's just hilarious the whole way through. There's a bunch of funny scenes in this film.
Like basically, it's I've always heard it described as like a ramen western, which up until I saw it,
Right.
I had no idea what that meant. And then, I think when we started assembling the team, and it was like Seven Samurai, and I was like, oh, I get what they're get, I get why it's called this now.
Well, and just like the two guys, the two truckers, Goro and Gunto, and it's
Ken Watanabe is the younger guy. He doesn't have much
yeah,
to do,
and
but it's I.
Tsutomu Yamazaki is the older one, Goro, Kurosawa regular Yamazaki. This might have been, it's not Ken Watanabe's first role, right? But this is kind of like his first maybe thing you
Yeah, I
might
think
notice
it's
him from,
his.
because this is before he did the Assassin TV show. And yeah, this is probably the earliest thing
Yeah,
I've seen
I
him in.
have never seen him. Like, I didn't know he was young at one point. Like, to me, when I think of him, I think of like middle-aged current Ken Watanabe, and like I think he's in Christopher
Right.
Nolan movies a lot.
Yeah, he's in one of the Batman movies. He's in Inception, I think. Yeah, he's definitely Inception. And then they give him old age makeup on top of being already kind of old. Yeah, I guess he's not that old, but like he has that sort of weathered look. Like, I don't know. Have you seen the Unforgiven remake?
The 90s one.
Oh, it just came out like last year, maybe. It's pretty much a shot-for-shot remake of Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven, but with Ken Watanabe, and it's in Japan.
No.
And he has that like grizzled, like the lines on his face, Clint Eastwood kind of look the whole way through. And it's almost exactly the same movie, just transplanted. But he does a really good Clint Eastwood in that film.
Yeah, but if they're listening to this right now, then you probably know the story. But if you don't know what the story is, it's very simple. These two truckers, Gunn and Goro, they come upon this ramen restaurant, and these random drunk guys are just kind of insulting the food, and and the Goro, they went a trucker's size to help this woman create the perfect bowl of ramen.
Well,
Yeah.
they get beat up, and she's kind of taking care of them after. And he's like, "Yeah, your ramen, it's whatever."
And then Kanata says, "Oh no, it sucks."
Yeah, he says it sucks, and so they decide to help her out. And when they're leaving, she's like, "No, come back! Like, actually, help me. I'll give you free pickles." And they sort of make it their mission to help her become a great ramen chef and reopen her restaurant, so it's a big success. And that's basically most of the film. It's like, trying to get her broth perfect, and again, there's a really funny scene where she's trying to figure out the recipe for this guy's broth, which is really good. And like, she's sneaking through the back rooms and like looking through like this people like in Psycho spying on him to see how he makes this broth, what the recipe is. And it's got training montages, it's got
Yeah,
all that
like the
stuff.
train
And
montage, it looks like she's on a bike and no, she's running and her trainer's on the bike and it looks like Punch Out, which
yeah, I have no idea what it has to do with making ramen, but it's
And like the
funny.
scene that made me think, is this where the Punch Out thing came from? Or maybe it's a reference to Rocky,
I thought maybe Rocky,
but
yeah.
it's still this absurd seeing that and then Goro just says, "Why the hell am I here?"
I mean, the comedy, the timing of it's always great, and there's so many weird moments. Like, it's a pretty unpredictable film, I find. Like, it just, even if you've seen it before, I feel like rewatching it, it just throws stuff at you that feels out of left field in a way that's really exciting and fun,
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's very funny. It's a great comedy, but it also happens to be a great movie. Like, just the way it explores our relationship with food in like literally every aspect, where with the main story, it made that I feel like it's the focus. Where am I going with this? I lost my thought.
Well, like, for me, the main story, what kind of makes it such a sweet relationship, mostly between Goro and Tampopo, is like, he clearly loves her and she loves him, but it's like not so much a romantic love as he just wants to see her be successful, and she's grateful for him kind of helping her find her dream, her ambition. And like, the moment at the end, of course, where they share that last smile, and then he goes off to his truck like a cowboy going off into the sun, like, "I've done my job and she doesn't need me anymore." And that's kind of the bittersweet happy ending.
Yeah, so you've seen it a couple times before. Do you interpret that as he is truly in love with her, and he just knows he can't be with
I
her
think
because there's a whole backstory of him having the failed marriage where he just couldn't adjust to like a normal, average life, where you go home to the wife every day and the kid and stuff.
I think that's exactly it, but it's not like a sad ending either, because he knows that he made her happy, and she, like, he doesn't really need to be married to her or anything like that to make her happy. He just knows that, helping her get the restaurant going and see her become this great ramen chef, like, that's what she needed, basically, So it's like there's a joy in him seeing her become successful, but like that smile you see in his face at the very end, like, he's, there's something sad about it too. Like, she doesn't need me, and I gotta move on. So that's how I take it.
Yeah, I can see that too, but it is a nice bittersweet ending, and the only thing with the ending that kind of confuses me is it feels like the contractor guy, was genuinely hurt at him leaving.
Yeah, that's sort of a weird friendship, because like, that's the guy who beats him up at the beginning, and then like halfway through the film they say, "All right, let's just settle this with our fists," and they get into this long fight. It's like the fight scene from They Live,
Oh,
I
yeah.
thought. It just goes on for a long time, and like, they're both laying in the ground just completely beat up, and they're friends. Like, they just got through all their issues through beating each other up, and they're on friendly terms all of a sudden, laying there like out of breath.
Yeah, and that's
it's such a good payoff when he's like, "Well, how can you help?" And he says, "I'm a contractor." And then you just see them remodeling the ramen shop. So that was sort of a sweet, surprisingly sweet relationship coming out of these guys who are just like violent with each other previously through the film.
Like, I love immediately tries to recruit him to help because I think he's the last person in the team was like a sensei who I don't think you ever get his actual name. He's a sensei.
No, he's just the old ramen master.
Yeah, who was a banker or something. Not a banker, a doctor. He had some normal job, and he came so obsessed with trying to make the perfect ramen that he lost his wife and his career. And he's like king.
Yeah, there's a really nice payoff with him too when at the very end, like Tampopo's finally made the perfect bowl of ramen, and he says, "Oh, like I didn't think a woman could be a great ramen chef, but you proved me wrong." And he's like smiling actually because, you know, he sort of realized he was wrong, and like just the way it's handled that my prejudices were broken down, like it's sweet actually.
Yeah, I just love that he's like the king of this homeless collective.
that's a really fun part too, and like that sort of contrasts with the whole business guy sitting around the table version of food too. And I mean it's like sweet the scene where the bum goes to make the rice omelet for the kid, Tempopo's son, and like they sneak into that kitchen
like a Buster Keaton, like Charlie Chaplin, so silent comedy.
Yeah, it feels a little like the kid or something like that. And then like the security guard coming in, and there's no sign or evidence of them. He just sniffs the air, and you know that something delicious was there. Like that's the only evidence he had, is just like a whiff of omelet in the air.
Yeah, and that's the little thing. And then all the homeless people are experts in food, and they all have their specialties and like what they're really like, and they call each other out like, "Oh, you're just being too picky right now," and you compare that to the scene of the businessmen and like these high class like rich men are very basic, and they aren't individuals, and these homeless people are. What their relationship with food is a lot more individual and specific.
Right.
So there's the sensei and contractor. Oh yeah, and there was the Shohei, who was the driver / cook for this old rich man that they rescue.
Yeah, the guy almost chokes on the. What was that he choked on? It was like. It looked almost like a fatty toffee or something, this like stretchy stuff. That really did look like it could get caught in your throat.
Yeah, and
easy.
Then they get out with a vacuum.
Yeah, when she shoves the vacuum in his mouth to save it.
Yeah, and oh God, that was so. This movie gets really gross sometimes, but that might be the grossest thing this movie does.
That's a pretty gross, like. From the beginning of that scene to like his recovery, it's like full of the gross stuff, I think.
Yeah, and like the old man is so grateful for them saving his life that he lets them use his basically his chauffeur, because their chauffeur happens to be an expert with noodles.
Right, and I think is it his daughter who keeps dropping him off. It's like the way you drop a kid off at the mall and be like, "I'll be back in 6 hours. Like, I gotta go do my errands." Just leave him at the ramen place for like a couple hours.
Yeah, like I thought it was like this a gold digger wife situation, but
oh, maybe I wasn't quite sure. I thought maybe it was the daughter, but it could have been a wife too. I don't know if they said or not. You just have to guess what that relationship is, or if they. I don't remember mentioning it,
but like you see, it's this much younger woman who I think she says the same thing every time. Like she's gonna leave him there, and she's gonna go to the bank and go shopping or whatever, and like that. And I know some people are sensitive to this thing, but when they first recruit Shohei, you see an on-screen animal death, which And if you haven't seen this, you know, just know that going in. I know some people are more sensitive to that stuff than others.
The turtle death, that's, I don't, it didn't bother me. I'm sure it would bother some people, but like it's a film about cooking and a lot of animals die in the process. I mean the turtles one thing, but what's a funny moment actually is when they're showing the ingredients and he's like, "Oh, I've got this special ingredient," and he unwraps the old ramen master unwraps the pig head. And Tempopo just faints on the spot, like being stared down by this pig's head. But yeah, you do see ingredients in the
Yeah, I
film.
mean it's relevant to the whole theme of everything. It's, you know, it's food. It's specifically about like pork ramen, trying to get the perfect pork ramen bowl. You have to kill an animal to get it, so it's not as flippant as like say some Italian movies from the 70s and whatnot.
No, it's not like one of those
You know,
cannibal
or like
films,
there's
or
some Jaws ripoff that's Italian where they kill a sh actual shark in the finale. So, you know, it's not like that. It serves a purpose.
within the film, it sort of plays with death a few times. Like some of the humor is a little bit dark. Like there's that one moment where you have the skit about the family and the mother's sick and she just kills over, and like it's a kind of a sad moment, but I still crack up when the father's like, "No, this is your it's your mother's last cooked meal, like eat it and enjoy it," and they're like all sobbing, just like stuffing their faces because they have to eat while it's still hot, the last meal that the mother cooked for them. Like it's such a dark moment, but I don't know, there's a couple things like that that sort of crack me up or surprise me again.
Yeah,
It's
that the father, and I feel like the introduction, you see his man sprinting somewhere, and you just keep following him.
yeah, what was
And it's,
he just like knocks the guy over, like
yeah, and it's, I think it's Hiroshi, I can't remember his name offhand, but he's in Pitfall, he's a miner who gets killed, he's in Tredescaden. I think he's the one that wears
okay.
red.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
All
he
right.
shows up in late Kurosawa stuff. He's in, what's the one? Rhapsody in August. He's the uncle who is obsessed with pineapple. Yeah, like
Okay.
he, yeah.
Okay. I didn't recognize him, but
Yeah, he's in. He's
yeah.
I think Imad Dayo. He's a pretty big part in that one too. So, you know, he at this point, you know, he's kind of a bigger actor at that point. But yeah, you just kind of see him sprinting, and then there are these doctors, this basically the wife on hospice. And I read one review that said she kills herself out of boredom, but
Oh, I don't
I
think
don't
that's it at
understand
all.
that. Maybe I watched the wrong movie. I don't really know.
No, she looks sick, like she's pale and sweaty and she just kind of dies. Yeah. I've walked out thinking like, "Oh yeah, there's that scene where this happened," and go and read online and realize like, "Oh, I completely misinterpreted that," or "Oh, like I just took that the wrong way at all,"
Yeah.
or you know. So sometimes you read older reviews and it's like completely inaccurate, or like they make some huge mistake, but it's like, yeah, how could you correct that without going back and watching the film again?
Yeah, but I like that little thing because it's really it's probably I think it's the darkest the movie gets, but it kind of goes into like it hinting at like, you know, it's like the role of like the wife and a mother and a family, and you have this
Right.
feeling of they didn't linger on it too long, but there's a sense of, well, things are going to change, and it's you don't know how the father will be.
It's just like enjoying that last moment of, you know, the sort of love that went into this dish of somebody you lost.
Yeah, like it relates to it's like the familiar structure. Like you have this last truly together moment with his family and.
I mean, there's another funny death scene in the film towards the end when the guy in the suit, the sort of
Oh, yeah.
classic, when he I they don't explain how he gets shot, right?
No.
It's just like you stumble upon, like you're in the middle of somebody else's movie.
Yeah, like
you just switch over and he's like all shot up, and the woman goes to him and he's saying like, "Oh, did I ever tell you about wild boar, eating wild boar?" And he goes in this big long thing about how to catch it.
Yeah,
and
like the boar eat yam, and once you kill it, you have to gut it, and so you can get the yam when it's like fresh in their intestines, so you can have.
And he's like, "Sounds pretty good, eh?" And he's like, "That's my last regret, is not eating wild boar with you." And at the very beginning of the film, he sort of sets up this idea that, oh, when you die, it's like seeing a short film of your life flash before your eyes, and you know, there's a callback to that in that scene. But that's also the guy who is in probably the most famous scene of the film, which is the egg kiss.
Yeah, which I'm not a prude. I've seen multiple Borovchek movies. I've seen I'm a fan of Josh Franco. I've seen more. Got a message on my phone. I've seen like, you know, more sexual erotic things, but this really caught me off guard.
It's so erotically charged, like, and creative too. Like, I mean, food's not my thing, but just the imagination of coming up with that and how to shoot it, I find really interesting. And like, it's just one of those things you don't forget after you've seen it. And I was telling you I was messaging you before we recorded about the movie Dead Sushi, the Noboru Iguchi's horror comedy, which parodies it. And the parody is so funny. If anyone gets a chance to see it, like, even if you just see that one scene, it's hilarious because, like, they pretty much do the exact same thing, except you kind of get a sense of how gross it would actually be to try it, because like the woman's just gagging on it, like for real, like like you can see it on her face. It's not like she's playing it up, but having a raw egg yolk in your mouth and passing it back and forth, and it's so funny to watch. If you ever get the chance, I'd recommend checking
that out.
Yeah,
I was going to try to look for it last night, but then I ended up watching Daisies for a third time this year.
That's a valid thing to do. That's like my favorite movie.
Yeah, Daisies has become kind of my go-to feel-good movie if I need to pick me up.
Also got a great food scene in it.
Yeah, that's true. But it's not as gross as just the egg yolk, which, like if you'd swallow the egg yolk.
Salmonella.
But also your stomach can't digest like raw egg like that. Like, you would either vomit feel really sick.
You know what I like doing, though, is, like, heating up rice so it's pretty hot, and then you crack the egg yolk open on it, and you can kind of see it cook, like, on the really, really hot rice. That usually tastes good. Or and if you're making ramen, like, just on your own, or even, like, that little, like, kimchi noodles, if you crack open the egg and drop it in, like, yolk and all, it'll turn white inside and cook, and it makes this sort of like globular shape, and it's kind of fun to eat. But raw egg yolk is about as gross as it gets.
Yeah, it just keeps
again, maybe another Rocky connection.
Yeah, because Rocky kind of
drinks egg yolk.
I think Rocky popularized the whole myth of you eat, like you drink a raw egg. In theory makes sense, but my dad was a science teacher for a long time, and he told me, if you do that, you're just going to throw it all up. And if you do that, you have to drink orange juice or some citrus, because that will calm your stomach enough to be able to digest all of it.
Yeah, I don't know anyone who would actually try it, but I would.
I have an uncle who, when he was in high school, he claimed that drinking raw egg was, you know, key to him staying fit for a football team, which I don't buy that.
Yeah. No. Is it Beauty and the Beast, the Disney version, where like the bad guy's saying like he eats like how many raw eggs a day?
Gaston,
like, isn't that a line in the musical number?
I haven't seen that over 20 years.
Okay, it's been a long yeah, it's probably the same for me. I just have this memory of him saying, like, I eat, like, five dozen raw eggs or something. But there's like a couple other like sort of like food porn scenes, erotically charged food scenes. Like there's
the whole one oyster where he's... sequence, which feels like a reference. I mean,
speaking
to,
of like,
there are these Pinku Roman porno films.
Oh, Diver G String Festival,
yeah,
whatever it's called.
It has to be a reference to those movies.
That movie, I forget what it's called. It's like Nympho Divers, or it's like some string of words. Maybe same words, different order. But they have like the an oyster that they cook on the shell over the fire, and it just looks like genitals. Like there's no getting around it.
Yeah,
it's this sort of like softcore kind of movie, sexploitation movie. But
yeah, and like the man in white, who apparently the man in white is a movie reference to. I forgot where. I read some review that kind of pointed out that it's a reference to some 40s or 50s movie. I forgot.
It seems like that, like just like he looks like a classic Hollywood kind of a character. Yeah. You know, he's dressed like that and acts like that. But when he cuts his lip on the shell, and then you get that dot of blood, and then he slurps it out of the diver's hand, and then she kisses him. Like it's a lot again, like exchanging sort of gross food fluids.
And she says, "You can eat it out of my hand." And it's like, oh wow, I didn't expect that to happen.
No, the film does make it very sexy, though. It's not like it looks gross when you're watching it. It's just if you stop to think about it, you're like, yeah, I probably wouldn't do that
in
real
life. And it's like, yeah, you don't know if it's good or not. You should probably cook that. And
raw oysters are good, though. Like, I mean, I know they can make you sick, but... And I forget where. I've heard before people saying, like, oh, oysters are aphrodisiac. Like, probably not, but at least that, like, idea is out there in the world, so there's, like...
And you get a great shot of the other oyster divers just watching. They don't say anything. They're just like, what the fuck is she doing?
I know, it's like a total spur of the moment thing, and I don't know, it's such a strange scene, but there's a couple of those
film. And the man in white, he and his lover, who I think was in Taxman Woman, playing one of the girlfriends of the villain, I'm pretty sure, or she might have been the last. Itami reused the same cast over and over again in different roles.
It's the actress who plays Tempopo Nobuko Miyamoto. She was married.
They were married for.
Yeah.
They got married, I think, 1970 or 69. So.
So that's even before they were.
Yeah, they've been together a while.
Yeah.
And I guess now's a good time as ever to bring it up. So Itami, he wrote and directed 10 films, and his career kind of ended abruptly when he was found dead, and it was a suicide that he jumped off the building of his where his office was, and
some people think maybe he was thrown out
because
it's pretty
one
shady,
of his movies, I think it's called Minbo somewhere, but it's Minbo no Anna, which is a Japanese title.
Murutai no Ona?
I can't remember the English title.
His last
no,
one,
no.
Right? I think it's called...
No, this was in 92. This is the movie that got him in trouble with the gangsters, apparently.
Okay,
it's like some...
Gentle Art of Extortion, something like that, right? I haven't seen it.
But apparently the Yakuza and gangsters did not like the depiction of them in that movie, and that kind of caused a not great relationship between Itami and gangsters, and so that kind of, some people speculate that maybe because in his movies he'd always depict them as kind of buffoons and stupid, that they threw him off the building. But it's not very... It's just a very murky situation, and it's unclear. I think it might have been murder, but I don't know. Martin, do you have any thoughts?
I wouldn't know. I know enough people who sort of say it's... murky, like it's not clear cut either way, so like I don't know if there's any solid evidence one way or the other, but yeah, it's pretty suspect. It's too bad. Like, I haven't seen all his films, but it seemed like he was on such a roll. I think starting with The Funeral and then Tempopo and Taxing Woman, and I think that's all I've seen of his. But you know, he had been working steady, and for you know, somebody who only got into filmmaking, I think he said he was
He
50,
was
right?
50 when he made the funeral. So he was 64 when he
Okay.
died.
You know, it seemed like he was really just entering a phase of his career where he could have been very productive and turned out in a lot of great films. But yeah, it's too bad he died when he did. And
Yeah, like just the ones I've seen, this made me think like just he's gone too soon. Just I would love to see what he'd be making now if he were still alive. I don't know if he still would have been making stuff. Well, maybe he would have been in his 80s, but you know, they're like Clint Eastwood is in his 80s, so you know, age doesn't really mean anything.
sure. No. And like, he also kind of struck me as maybe a filmmaker who would have really like jumped onto digital and sort of the non-linear editing. And it seems like just the way he made films, he might have been somebody who could have thrived in that environment. You know, had he lived maybe another decade or more. But yeah, I don't know.
At least Miyamoto's still alive and she's still active and acting. I think most of his regulars are still alive. A lot of them are in their 80s at this point. I think Miyamoto is a bit younger than he was, but yeah, a lot of them are just, you know, still around. I don't know how many of them are still acting, but
'Cause, like, Yamazaki must be pretty
man, he's
old
in his
now, 'cause
mid-80s.
like he's in High and Low, he's in
Yeah.
Kagemusha. Like, he's probably around the same age as Nakadai, right?
Yeah, they're around there.
'Cause I mean, they played the twinsies in Kagemusha,
Wait,
so
that was
yeah,
okay. Yeah, I didn't realize that was him in that.
but I'm trying to think what else I might have seen him in. The Kurosawa films I know for
Who is
sure,
he in High and
and
Low?
he's one of the
Is he
criminals,
the
right?
villain?
I think so. He's the one that Nakadai speaks to. I'd have to go back and find it, but I think he's in Redbeard. I forget if he's in Ren or not. I'm not
But
sure.
he,
Maybe
when I
not.
think of him, I always think of him as Gondo and a Taxing Woman, and I just love his
Okay.
performance in a Taxing Woman so much. He's such a slimy, horrible, like a tax evading criminal. Yet you can't help to feel
Yes.
sympathetic, not sympathetic, but like he's so
He's likable though. Like he knows how to make it charming.
and it's his performance in that compared to this. Is this such a world difference where, like, it's like, oh, this guy is actually incredible? Because in this one, he's like a Clint Eastwood, like, rough and tumble type. And then in the next movie, he's this very intellectual.
Suave, kind of slimy
Yeah, and he
business
walks with a
guy.
limp, and his physicality is completely different.
Yeah, I'm peeking now on the Google. So Miyamoto, she did a voice in The Tale of Princess Kaguya. So that's recent, recent enough. That's really great, the Isao
Yeah,
Takahata
rest in
film.
peace. He's gone too soon.
Yeah.
He's in the 80s, but still, he is still
Man.
active, still making movies.
Yeah, and the actor who played the guy in the suit, the gangster-looking guy, Koji Yakusho, he was in the 13 Assassins remake, and he was in World of Kanako. So yeah, I guess he's pretty
Yeah,
busy
so,
still.
oh.
Oh, he's in Imamura as the
Ooh,
Eel.
I have
That's
that on
right.
DVD. Have yet to. Well,
Yeah.
I'm going to probably try to review that. But Immamora is hard.
That's great.
It's hard for me to wrap my head around
Yeah.
completely.
There's a pretty shocking scene like right from the get-go, and then it's after that it kind of takes a turn into the, I guess, softer side for Imamura. It's great, especially like if you've seen some of his other films, it kind of feels like him reflecting on his own career in a lot of ways. The Eel's
Yeah,
really
I've seen
great.
Dr. Akagi, which I love. I immediately ordered the Korea DVD once I watched it on movie.
And it's too bad his stuff's not easier to get a hold of. Like, there's a couple from the Criterion over here, but I don't know. The Eel's fantastic. Yeah, well, I did a whole episode. I
don't know if listened
you've
to the first
heard up
5 minutes,
to
and I was like, I haven't seen enough. I'll be spoiled. I want to watch all these.
Right. Because, like, you know, his Ballad of Narayama remake, like, there should be a Blu-ray. Black Rain, there should be a Blu-ray. Like, all the late career stuff. Like, his New Wave stuff's fantastic, but, like, I don't know. I feel like people should see Warm Water Under a Red Bridge. Like, those movies are amazing.
Yeah, like,
so good. Profound Desire of the Gods. Like, holy smokes.
Yeah, like, this might sound crazy, but I feel like Imamura and Itami deserve to be... there's a big three of it. Kurosawa, Ozu, and Mitoguchi. But I feel like Itami and Imamura kind of deserve to be included such a big, like, a big five instead.
Yeah, for sure. I think so. I mean, Itami, I'm going to have to see the rest of his films at some point, but
like,
at least Tempopo, it seems like, has a pretty strong appreciation.
And Imamura, just, I feel like his stuff adjusts. I don't know what, maybe it's rights issues with the family. I don't really know.
That might be part of it. I know too, like, I had a hard time getting into Imamura at first. Like, you see Vengeance is Mine, you're like, I'm done. Like, I don't know if I can take any more of this. Or, you know, like, something like Insect Woman, you're like, oh my god, like, how can I watch another film ever again, any film?
Well, for me, it was Pornographer, like, and I was like, I have to see what else he makes.
Exactly, yeah. No, he's great. I just find, like, his stuff, it weighs on you pretty heavily, like, after. It's not like... I don't, like, even Kurosawa, when he's doing something like Seven Samurai that's 3 hours long and, like, you know, substantial, it's obviously, like, one of the greatest films ever made, you can kind of watch it and go on with the rest of your day.
Yeah.
I feel like Imamura is so great, but also, like, I have to kind of know that my day is going to be ruined the second I put one of his films into the player.
Yeah, Dr. Akagi is kind of made my next 24 hours just made me just reflect on everything.
But, like, they're not... He's funny, though.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I feel like that goes a long way. Like, he's got a really good sense of humor, which makes his films not just, like, I don't know what you'd say, just exercises in depression or something like that.
It's...
But, you know, he's got such an interesting outlook on the world. I think, he should definitely be up there.
Based off the Tommy I've seen, I feel like his stuff should be more available, because it's kind of like Andrei Zulawski, where people, like, see Possession. I feel like with Tempopo, what I've kind of noticed was a lot of people say, like, oh, I love Tempopo, that I mentioned, well, I've seen others by him. It's like, oh, no. And it's kind of like, well, there's other stuff to dig into.
Sure. I mean, I think, like, if people enjoy Tempopo, the next place to go is probably A Taxing Woman, right? Because it's, like, what Tempopo does for food, A Taxing Woman does for tax evasion. not really, but, you know, it's the same cast, basically. It's similar sense of humor, same sense of heart and emotion. Like, you know, I think that's a pretty easy one to slide into once you've seen Tempopo. Or you might even, you said you might recommend it as an introduction before even seeing Tempopo. So.
Yeah, like, for me, in my taste, it was a better introduction than Tempopo, which I don't think would have, I don't think it would have clicked with me as much.
Is it because Tempopo's, like, less
Maybe.
Linear?
But usually, at this point, I like less linear stuff, but there's just something about A Taxing Woman just really hit. Like, this struck a chord with me. We did an episode, me and Joel did an episode on The Last Dance, his movie from 1993. It's not as good as these. It's the ones from what I've seen, it's the one I like the least, but it still has his weird, quirky sense of humor. And it's does the Tommy thing of you see the process of a job, and, like, it's about a director, and it's the last year of his life as he dies of cancer. And so after, at a certain point, just the jokes end, and it's kind of weird seeing Tommy just suddenly kind of
get serious.
It doesn't fully work, but it definitely is worth watching. But for me, I watched it a little too soon after my grandma died of cancer, and some of the stuff hit.
It's hard to watch. Yeah, I I feel like he's good at the drama stuff too. He's sort of focused on the comedy because that's what stands out. But like, there are moments of drama in Tampopo that I think work well and are subtle. And it seems like what might be a common theme throughout his films. Obviously, I haven't seen them all, but just you mentioning that makes me think that like there's a focus on process.
You see people's jobs, you know, and a taxing woman. You see the process of trying to take down someone for tax evasion. And it sounds so boring to say that out loud, but when you watch the movie, you're sucked into the world like, oh yeah, this is an interesting job someone has.
I feel like any film that really shows you how something's done is interesting, or maybe it's just me, but like to see the process done well and properly, it's always kind of compelling, I find. You know, the parts of Tampopo, like I'm totally transfixed on the cooking, and there's a few films I really like that are about particularly that the process of cooking somehow, and then you can kind of weave a subtext into it and weave, you know, human emotions into it. Like one of my favorite films ever made is Oxide 2, and it's basically 2.5 hours of family making dumplings. And you just find out what the family dynamics are and what their problems are, but also sort of, you know, there's an interesting craft and tradition and sort of how to bring yourself into the crafting of dumplings. Like, I think you can do a lot with food. And, you know, he even in Tampopo, he draws a parallel between not so much the cooking of the foods, but like what Goro's doing and filmmaking. Mm-hmm. Like there's that one line where he said, oh, like I'll be the director basically. And you'll do what I say. Like he pretty much comes out and says, you know, that the relationship between Goro and Tampopo, it's a little bit like the relationship between the director and an actor.
I
can kind of see, you know, if he's going to do a film about a filmmaker, it would kind of, you know, be a little bit like that aspect of Tampopo stripping away the sort of surface of the food and the comedy. It would kind of feel like just bringing that subtext to the surface.
And the Last Dance is about a director, and if it's autobiographical, then he probably wasn't the greatest guy in the world. Because the lead director, the old man in that, he is cheating on his wife and sleeping with the lead actress. But in the case of Itami, the lead actress was always his wife, so it just kind of... A reading of that on Last Dance would be kind of interesting and weird to look at from that angle.
I'm going to have to see it. I'm just looking at... Did you know that there's a sequel to Taxi
Woman? Yes, I knew. Called Taxi Woman Returns.
Okay, this is news to me. I didn't know this. Everyone came back for it.
I haven't watched it yet because I heard Yamazaki plays it, is either not in it or plays a different character. Yeah, that kind of...
Chishiro's in it? What? Okay. Alright, that's news to me.
that sold me on that.
Oh, it's on YouTube. Great, I'll watch it. I mean, I feel like we covered most things in Tampopo. Oh, maybe you should mention that one scene with the guy who has the toothache and he can't eat dumplings, so he goes to the dentist and it's like he has a stinky abscess or something like that. So before I'd ever seen Tampopo, I'd just seen that scene on its own. Somebody showed it to me and I was like, what is this? Like, you don't know if it's supposed to be like funny or what when you just see that scene on its own, but like later on you realize it's hilarious. And I just like that moment when he sees the kid, because like he can only eat soft food, so he's eating ice cream, and this kid's got a sign on him that says don't feed him any sweets, and he just has that like defiant look on his face when he hands the kid this ice cream, and you see the kid's like hand like opening and closing, like he's just so excited to have an ice cream, he doesn't know what to do with himself.
Like all the cutaways seem, well, a lot of them seem to do with like food and vice in some way, because there's like the food and sex with a couple of food, and you know, breaking the rules with the kid who can the sign says he can only have natural and organic foods, and the sign his mother, and there's that. There is Probably my favorite sequence is the old woman in the supermarket who is just groping all the food.
Yes. Oh, we didn't mention that. That one's a really funny scene when, like, the guy managing the grocery store catches on to what she's up to, and he's after her with the little fly swatter. Like, that also feels very silent film
And
kind of
it's
comedy.
like excellent sequence. It's my favorite part of the whole movie, and he's just trying to hunt her and trying to catch her in the act.
Yes. Because you see people do that for real, and it just kind of takes it to the extreme of like filling this food and she's pushing her thumbs into like a peach till it bursts and like ruining the cheeses, all the soft cheeses. And he's so happy when he catches her in the act.
And it's like it feels like a continuation of like the food and sex. Like it's almost like fascistic, the way this old woman is just like getting off on like ruining the food.
Filling up the food. Or I don't know, there's it kind of reminded me of Clerks, like they sort
Oh
of make fun
yeah.
of people going in and like counting every egg and like, you know, just sometimes when you work in a store like that you notice people doing weird things.
Yeah, and there's the whole the prawn tickle thing, which
Right.
I didn't know you eat prawn live, but
I don't
I that part confused me a little bit more so than the being tickled by prawn.
I don't know. Is there anything that you eat live? I don't think I eat stuff
I
live.
can't think of anything.
Unless it's like what's it called? It's like, oh, shucks. I'm gonna blank on what it's called. This stuff, it's almost like yogurt, except it's got like a living
Oh,
culture in it.
I know what you're talking about. I can't think of the name offhand.
Shucks, I can't believe I'm forgetting that. Anyway, that's alive when I eat it, but that's about it. You know, if like.
Yes. Was there anything else? The editor who was Atami's editor, I think, for his whole career is Akira Suzuki, who was
Okay.
Seiji Suzuki's editor for basically his entire career.
Were they
I tried
related?
to look into that, and as far as I can tell, they were not.
Okay.
But
Oh, I might have heard you say that before on the show, so I'm.
Akira Suzuki,
Yeah.
it's Seiji Suzuki related, so I kind of have to bring that up. But
Right. There's a Suzuki connection.
The
Yeah.
cinematographer shot
No,
Lady
it's.
Snowblood, my least favorite of the Makoto Kaji films.
Okay. Well, Juzo Itami, he's in Lady
I
Snowblood, right?
believe so, because he was an actor. I don't know if he's a major actor or not, but I know he did have an acting career.
Yeah, I don't think he was like a big star or anything, but like I know he showed up in Makioka Sisters, which that's like a Kon. Usually I like Kon Ichikawa, but I can hardly ever make it through that film. I've tried multiple times and it just never works for me, the Makioka Sisters. I think it's based on a novel, right?
I know the movie, but I have not seen.
Okay, it's like a period film, but it feels super 80s if you see it. Like it's like really glossy in the soundtrack. I don't know. Something about it doesn't work for me, but it's supposed to be like one of the great masterpieces, so I don't know. It might just be me.
I really did enjoy this a whole lot. I love the little, I love. It's like to me, this is just far more a comedy than it's a drama. It happens to be a comedy with a lot of substance to it.
But it's, you know, there's a poignancy to it and the profundity. Like that last image that the credits roll up on of the woman breastfeeding the baby, it's like, yeah, food's such a central part of our lives, you know, from the moment we're born to when we're dying, maybe thinking about a last meal or something like that. It's just something that's a essential part of the human experience.
It's exploring like food through like I mentioned, like through vice and food through like etiquette and food through I'm trying to think of a way to rope in like the businessman scene, maybe like food through the
That's like
food
through
culture.
culture, through,
Like
you know,
it just explores in like every aspect of food in like this in human, existence. And I think that's one of the things that makes this so so universal, is just everyone can relate to something in this movie.
I mean, the opening scene too, I should say, or not the very opening scene in the movie theater, but like the second scene where it's Ken Watanabe talking about trying to learn how to eat ramen from this expert. It kind of sets the tone for the rest of the movie, where he's sort of explaining like how to appreciate it, like don't just like gobble it down basically. But then at the end, when he's tapping the pork on the edge of the bowl, and like Ken Watanabe's looking at him with these like wide eyes, like wow, is that some kind of a ritual? Like, you know, what's the meaning of that? And he's like, oh, you just like tap the liquid off. So, you know, like to me, that kind of says, like, okay, we're not gonna be pretentious about this.
Yeah, and I in the whole backstory of Goro, that kind of, well, Tampopo you learn as a widow, and that kind of, a film shorthand to make you feel sympathy for her, but it's shorthand for a reason. But the whole thing with Goro and his wife leaving him, and he was married with children and stuff, that whole reveal is so genuinely touching and heartwarming, and really, he's kind of like the, like I mentioned, he's kind of Clint Eastwood a bit, and has that like Clint Eastwood distance where like where you don't know anything about him, and suddenly get this one little nugget of his backstory, and that just makes you like him even more.
He doesn't have to come out with some kind of exposition dump. They just give you enough to care and know that this character has a backstory and he has a reason for maybe why he acts the way he acts. So, no, it's really well handled. Like the dramatic aspects are subtle and effective.
Yeah, I don't know if Crocodile Dundee had come out by this point, but he looks like Crocodile Dundee, at least at first glance. But then I kind of realized, oh wait, that's Clint Eastwood like Western thing actually, not Crocodile Dundee.
He looks like he could wrestle a crocodile, though. Like,
Yeah,
I'd buy that.
he wears the hat almost every scene except for when he takes a bath. Yeah, he briefly. I think he sees her underwear drying, and he gets embarrassed and puts his hat back on or something.
Well, like, he's washing his hair and then putting his hat immediately back on, which, like, I just keep thinking, oh, that's how you get greasy hair, but. Yeah, that's a really good. No, he never takes it
And
off.
the horns on the truck remind me of Tukibuki, which, yeah,
Oh, yeah.
which kind of ties into the whole killing animals on screen, which that movie is, if you're sensitive to that, that's a tough movie to get through.
You know which movies kill animals on screen? The best ones. Andrei Rublev, Tukibuki. No, I'm joking, but those movies are great, so too
And a whole bunch of cheap Italian knockoffs that probably aren't worth trying to
and a
track
bunch
down.
of cheap Italian movies. Like all those Mondo Cane sequels.
Yeah, and all their Mad Max rip-offs or whatever.
Sure. Anyway, so it's the topic we can't
Yeah.
escape.
So do you have any final thoughts? Anything else left on Tampopo or Juzo Itami?
I don't think so. I just recommend people see the film and be ready with food, preferably ramen if you can
Oh
manage
yeah.
it.
Watch this with food or after you've eaten. It's not a good idea to watch it if you're hungry.
No.
Yeah, like there's a ramen restaurant kind of near-ish me that I suddenly, after watching this, I just want to go there and have like a proper ramen meal now.
I know, like, that's pretty much what I'm gonna do as soon as we're done recording. I'm gonna go grab food. But yeah, that's it, I think.
Would you recommend A Taxing Woman and the Funeral?
Oh, for sure. I think Taxi Woman's better than Funeral, I'd say, but yeah, I'd recommend
Yeah,
them both.
Funeral has, I think, the one of the final film appearances of Fujiwara from Hidden
Okay.
Fortress.
So do you want to talk about 1985 movies or?
You can start.
Okay. Good 1985 movie I'd recommend that has Japanese connection is Mishima: Life in Four Chapters, the Paul Schrader film about the notorious author Yukio Mishima. It's probably Paul Schrader's best film. It's kind of like if it sort of follows a similar trajectory as Taxi Driver, this guy kind of falling into a weird sort of suicidal fantasy. But it's very cerebral, and you kind of go into and it's it utilizes Mishima, some of his novels, to kind of give you an idea of like how his personal philosophy evolved. And he's a very disturbing person if you read about him, but very compelling and intelligent, just very focused on a particular course that led him to do something very extreme. But that's a really, really great film. I think it's Paul Schrader's best film. And it's starring Ken Ogata as Mishima. So that's one. And if you are in the mood for something lighter, I'd recommend checking out Lost in America by Albert Brooks, who's in it, and Julie Haggerty's in it. And it's sort of almost making fun of like these type of movies where people drop out of society and they want to live like Easy Rider. Like there are these two yuppies who are just gonna like travel across America, man, and they're gonna live in an RV, but things don't go the way they'd expect. And basically, by the end, they're like, "No, take us back to our jobs." So, yeah, it's a really funny movie. I don't know if people are fans of Albert Brooks, but I think he's one of my favorite kind of comic filmmakers, and you know, he has a similar touch for lighter stuff and drama and kind of mixing it all together. So if people like Tanpopo, they might by some chance like Lost in America.
Yeah, I've always been meaning to watch more of his stuff. I only know him from Drive and Hank Scorpio on You Only Live
Oh,
Twice. I think that's season 7. That's The Simpsons, if no one got
that's probably
that.
first thing I kind of I didn't know who he was, but that's probably the first place I encountered him. And then, like, I saw broadcast news, and it's just like, oh, I need to see more of this guy. And then when you find out he's a really good director, you just kind of have to dive in. Like, I bet you would really like Modern Romance.
I've heard of that for a while, just haven't got a tablet Brooks yet.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, I haven't checked if his stuff is like for on like Amazon or anything.
I think Lost in America Criterion put it out sort of recently, like maybe a year or two ago. And Modern Romance, it's not, I don't think there's an American Blu-ray, but the Indicator company put it out on Blu-ray in the UK, and that's region free. So if you order that, it should just play in the regular
Okay.
player if you're in North America.
Oh yeah, Alan Brooks. I always forget he's in Finding Nemo too.
Right, he's
Yeah,
Nemo's dad.
but
He's got a good voice, which like he always plays these kind of comic, kindly characters. Actually, he's in Taxi Driver, so there's double
oh yeah,
Schrader
he's
connection in my mind, I guess.
the political,
The
like the
political guy,
intern
yeah.
or whatever, like the friend of the I can't remember her name, but like he.
The girl that Travis
Yeah.
Bickle falls for, yeah. So yeah, he's in Taxi Driver too, but like he usually plays nice guys, and then like in Drive, it's almost like he's playing the I don't know, Harvey Keitel character a little bit from Taxi Driver. Like he's the bad
Yeah.
guy and he's violent, and that's such a like out of character kind of role for him, but he's so good at it. I really like him in Drive.
Yeah. Man, I love Nicholas Ruff Winding. What's his fucking name? Nicholas Winding Refn.
Nicholas Winding Refn.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I generally love like every movie I've seen by him.
I like pretty much all of them, like some more than others. The only one that didn't really do it for me was
Oh,
Neon Demon.
weird. Like that's of
But
his, that's kind of my
like
favorite. But I like Elle Fanning. She
okay.
just seems really cool, and she has a really interesting screen presence.
Yeah, she's really good. But like, I'm also the guy who saw Only God Forgives like multiple times in the theaters,
Oh,
so you know, people might not take my word for it. I don't know.
yeah.
I love Only
I
God
get
Forgives.
why
I think that movie's
people
fantastic.
don't like it, but I really connect with that. Other th there's a one
I
scene
think
I
my
can't
favorite movie.
handle with a guy getting his eye cut.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's really violent, but my favorite movie that Nicholas Winding Refn's done, though, I think is Pusher 2, which, like, if you go into the behind-the-scenes stuff, basically he just had to make a sequel to Pusher because he needed a financial hit because Fear X flopped. So he's like, oh, like, I'm under all this stress, I'm a new father, and, like, it's kind of weird, like, he made it for purely financial reasons, but just by channeling that, like, pressure, being, like, a new father and having no money and being kind of desperate, it like makes the film really
Yeah.
personal. And I don't know, it's got like I think by far the best ending of any of the Pusher movies. And like that's kind of the place where I said, oh, Mads Mikkelsen, that's the guy to watch. Like, he's gonna be a big, like, he's a great actor, he's gonna be a
Yeah.
star, you know. He's really, really good in that film. Like, that's one of his best performances.
Yeah, I feel like the one of the few people who generally likes Valhalla Rising.
Oh, I love Valhalla
It's
Rising. And I know I like Fear X a lot too. Like, people seem to not, I don't even know if like at this point it's that people don't like it so much as like people don't even know it exists, but it's really, really good. And like, I like Nicholas Winding Refn's slower kind of, like, he almost has two modes. And I don't, whatever mode Valhalla Rising's in, I like that a lot, even though I know not everyone
Yeah.
does.
Oh, I should get to my 1985 movies. Well, Alice,
Sure.
get this out of the way. Yeah, we both know, Martin and I both know that Aliens came out this year. That's the obvious one. Back to the Future. There are a couple where a Breakfast Club. Yeah, but it's boring to bring those up. So for me, mine is probably my favorite 80s teen movie. It's a ridiculous. I guess it's so bad it's good, but it's so ridiculous. It's really enjoyable. Tough Turf from '85. It stars James Spader, Robert Downey Jr., and Kim Richards. And Kim Richards, she was an actress, and now she is on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills or something like that. She's one of those people.
So she's still an actress. No.
And she's Paris Hilton's aunt. But Tough Turf is James Spader's this rich kid from Connecticut, and his family, I think, lost a bunch of money for some reason, and so they have to move to L.A. And he immediately is targeted by the local bullies at his high school because I think he has a fancy bike or something. And so he becomes friends with Robert Downey Jr., who doesn't have much to do, but he plays drums in a band, and he performs shirtless and like wears like a Chippendale dancer like things around his neck and wrist. It's kind of weird, but yeah, they're attack dogs at a certain point. It's a weird teen action like teen movie that turns into like a revenge action movie kind of thing at the end. And they get away with murder, and they just have a dance party, and nothing matters. But it's ridiculous. There's a moment of insane sound design where they're eating fish sticks for dinner, but the sound design makes it sound like they're eating overly baked crackers because the crunch is so loud. But it's on YouTube in full. There's a DVD double pack. There's a DVD, but it's kind of printed as a double pack with some other movie that's a lot cheaper. But I highly recommend this really stupid teen movie. And the other two movies I recommend are two. I have not seen these, but I will soon-ish. They are Hideo Gosha films. One is called Ore from 1985, and one is called Tracked. Tracked is on Filmstruck, and I will cover that in an upcoming article for my blog. And Ore, as far as I know, has had not had a release outside Japan, but if you go through like bootleg roots, you can get a hold of it. But yeah, Gosha was very productive in the 80s. He, I think, produced, he directed 11 movies in the 80s.
85 is a good year. I'm peeking out to some of the other stuff I forgot to mention. If you want a Kurosawa connection, 1985 was the year Runaway Train
Oh,
came
yeah.
out, which was originally going to be directed by Kurosawa. That was going to be his American Hollywood English language premiere, but that didn't work out. So instead, it ended up being directed by Andrei Konchalovsky, who was the co-writer of Andrei
Oh.
Rublev and would go on to direct Tango and Cash.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And Taipei Stories, 1985, Quiet Earth, 1985, Prixie's Honor, bunch of good films. Good
Oh,
year all
and
around.
Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Right. Did you see they're coming out with a new
They
Rambo?
are? Huh.
Yeah. It's going to be called Rambo Last Blood.
Okay.
Which, I don't know why you would make another one, but I feel like calling it the last something just means that they're going to have to make another one. It's like when you have like the Final
Yeah.
Friday or something like that. It's like, oh, of course, you need to awkwardly bring back the franchise.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going
And
through.
yeah, they released the set picture and it's like Sylvester Stallone in a cowboy hat. So I don't know. People were making fun of Rambo being a cowboy now.
God, there's so much stuff from this year.
I know, right? I feel like, I don't know if it's just like when I grew up, but it's like all the like late 80s stuff, like those were all like big touchstones for me, even though I grew up like a little bit later. It's just like those were the films that were haunting the video stores that I would like dive into and rent and discover. So it's like a whole bunch of films that I really like that I kind of grew up with as I'm scrolling through. Oh man.
Okay, I found two more I just have to mention. The Last Dragon,
Okay.
produced by Barry Gordon. It's not a good movie, but it's very entertaining. It's Barry Gordon founded Motown Records, and so all the music is Motown music from the 80s, and the soundtrack is great if you're into that music. And the lead actor, he kind of sucks, and he's the one bad part of the movie. But sure enough, who the actor was in The Disco Godfather, playing Rudy's nephew who's addicted to drugs.
Oh, yes. I
Yeah.
didn't know. He's addicted to. I know, I know. Oh my God.
Yeah, that's him. And yeah, Last Dragon, if you haven't seen it, it's totally worth watching. It's so goddamn entertaining. And Invasion USA came out this year, and my only real interesting thing to point out about that is the cinematographer for that movie, he was a cinematographer for Deep Throat.
Huh, well, I don't know. What a
Yeah,
career.
he was
What a
interviewed on the
career.
Rialto Report some time ago. He has had a real fascinating life.
That's a. Oh my God, I love the Rialto Report. Like, half the stuff I don't even know what they're talking about, and I just find it
Oh yeah, and some
fascinating.
stuff is like, holy shit, they kind of had a mainstream career I just never knew about.
Yeah. No, like, people did for a little while. It was like border. It was like one step below horror films. It was just like tittering on
Yeah.
legitimacy for a little while in the sort of, late 70s to mid 80s. But oh, if we're going to mention action films, one more. Yes, Madam came out in
Oh, Michelle
1985.
Yeoh.
That's with Michelle Yeoh. Yeah,
Yeah,
and Cynthia
I live in
Rothrock
Delaware.
with it.
I've been grew up here, and
Okay.
Cynthia Rothrock is from Delaware.
She's great. I know her from like the Hong Kong stuff, but she had like a whole
Oh,
American
I
career,
know,
which I've
like
just
China
never
O'Brien.
dipped my toe into. Yeah, like she's got a. I think that one was still like a Golden Harvest co-production, but I don't, like some of the direct-to-video stuff I never watched. But she's really great with Michelle Yeoh, where they have like the high fives with each other, and they play off each other really well in that film. And the action's like top tier. Like it's if you're into the Hong Kong 80s action movies. I think it like stands shoulder to shoulder with some of the best
Oh
stuff
yeah,
of that
Cynthia
era.
Rothrock is the best. She, I think she deserved a much better career than what she got.
I think so, yeah, like she should have been, like she should have been like headlining films the way like
Yeah,
Jean-Claude Van Damme was, or like those kinds of action
but
stars.
well, that's really happened with women. But she still had a great
Yeah.
career with this like direct to video stuff. And I think she is still active.
I think like Marcus pointed out on Twitter, he's like, how did like Kelsey Grammer get to be an expendable before
Yeah,
Cynthia
exactly.
Rothrock? Like the expendable franchise is a
Why
joke.
not like San
Like
yeah, why not
you have all
Sandahl
these.
Bergman? She was in a bunch of the Coen shit. She's great with action.
I know. I don't like those expendable films
I
really.
like
Like,
the second one a bit more because it's sillier.
okay.
The first one is a little too serious.
Yeah, like what's weird about the first one is it's sort of posturing itself as like, hey, we're gonna be a throwback to those like 80s, 90s kind of action films that you grew up with. Except it's not shot like that at all. It has zero of the charisma or charm of those films. It's just like, oh, like you decided to take all those action stars and make like a generic contemporary action film with them.
Yeah,
That's
it's
not
pretty
cool.
forgettable, but two is
Yeah.
it was entertaining for what it was. I saw it in the theater. I'll never see it again. And then
Right.
three, I skipped because it's
Right.
PG-13. I was like, nah, the cast is way too big for what's right.
Who's in that
Too many
one?
people.
I think Wesley
Yeah.
Snipes is in that. Yeah, too many people.
Antonio Banderas.
Mel Gibson.
Yeah,
Mel
well, he's a
Gibson's in it,
racist. I
right?
don't watch anything he's in anymore.
I know. Of course, Mel Gibson's in it.
All right. Don't you have a podcast based in Canada about flicks?
That's what they tell me. If you want to hear more of me and more of Spencer, check out FlixWise Canada. We just had an episode go up about David and Lisa. Like I mentioned, there's a Luis Buñuel episode on the way too. What else is coming up? I don't, there's a few things in the works. There's a big Japanese director film that we're doing a Christmas episode for, I think. So hopefully that comes together. I'm really,
Is it
really excited for
Kurosawa's
that.
Scandal, which is a secret Christmas movie?
That would have been a good one
Oh.
to as a Christmas movie. No, it's probably the one that everyone's
Okay.
guessing. Yeah, so there's lots to look forward to. There's a few things planned, and on the regular Flix wise, we had an episode go up not that long ago about Children of Paradise with Becky Deanna, and that was a really fun one. So check out flixwise.com, and I'm also on Twitter at Movie Kessler if you want to see me tweet about movies. I spent the afternoon tweeting about new Taiwanese cinema, so if you like stuff like that, check out my Twitter, I
And
guess.
didn't you, weren't you recently-ish on Film 89 talking about Predator franchise?
I was yeah, I was on Film 89 complaining about The Predator. Because I really, really love the first two, and after that, it's a pretty sharp decline, I find. So that's a place where I'm at. What else have I been a guest on? I was on the Criterion podcast talking about Equinox not that long ago. Criterion Reflections with David Blakesley. That's a neat film. What else have I been? I don't know. I show up on
Yeah.
stuff. You probably
Yeah,
heard
you're
me
on wrong
before.
reel like every few months or so.
Right, I've got a Wrong Reel one coming up pretty soon. I did an episode on Zatoichi Goes to the Fire Festival maybe last month for Criterion Reflections
Oh,
also.
that
I
has
think my
Peter in it.
last. Yeah, that he's nice. I know him through like the Facebook groups, but it was cool having a chance
No, I
to meet
mean
him.
the Zatoichi Goes to Fire Festival, Peter, the actor, the
Oh, PETA from Funeral
Yes,
Parade of
he's in it.
Roses. Yeah, he's also in Ran, and he's really good in Zatoichi Goes to the Fire Festival, hitting on Zatoichi, and he's kind of like I guess sort of like a femme fatale type character.
Yeah,
But
I guess.
male fatale, I don't know what how you'd change
he
that.
well. Okay, this term is used in the film, Funeral Parade of Roses, but he is a gay boy. But if you watch
Right.
the movie, you know it's not offensive. It just means something else.
One thing I kind of like about Funeral Parade of Roses is it's just like from an era when there wasn't really a vernacular for a lot of this. If actor like interviews with real people on the
Well,
films
allegedly
sort of
real
saying
people,
like,
there's some question behind that.
oh sure, well, I mean like some are
Yeah.
actors obviously, but like there are interviews with like real
for the best.
Depending, like, transgender or drag queens, or like, oh, you know, when they do the real interviews, and it's like, do you live full time? You know, there wasn't really like a language to sort of describe what everyone felt like. So it was just sort of interesting to see that subculture at that particular point in the 1960s. So,
And Peter, went on to have a good film career. He shows up in, I think he's in two Goshen movies in the 80s. He's in Tracked, and I feel like he shows up in another one. One of the ones that's not available unless you get a bootleg. But that's
right. No, he's in a bunch of films actually. A good solid career. And he always pronounces it
Peter.
Pita. I just got used to saying Pita when he
Oh,
shows up in a
I'm
movie.
just seeing him credited as Peter
But
because that's kind of how he's credited in translated to
right,
English.
because I think he said it's like from Peter Pan. Like that was kind of his persona, like boyish Peter Pan, when he was doing I don't know, like burlesque type stuff. Drag shows or whatever, so that's where he picked up the name from. But yeah, if you ever hear him like talk, that's just how he pronounces it. So yeah, so there's more of me on podcasts. I did the Blade trilogy on
Oh
Raw and
yeah,
Real
I
not that
remember
long ago. That's another I was on Russophiles United, Re not
that.
United, Unite, Russophiles Unite movie podcast.
You had to correct that because Alistair will listen to this.
I know. I always want to call it Russophiles United, but it's Russophiles Unite. I feel like it should have an exclamation
I
point, but
recorded episode four on Ivan's childhood, my favorite Tarkovsky. But I will be back on that. I was on the Tsar episode, which is episode 8 or 9.
yeah, that's a fun one, talking about Ivan the Terrible. Or not so terrible, depending on your historical perspective,
I kind of
apparently.
saw that, took it as an excuse to geek out on my favorite era of Russian history.
No, that's a perfectly good excuse. I'm going to be looking forward to the Ivan the Terrible one because I'm a big Tarkovsky person,
Ivan's childhood.
and Ivan's Childhood's probably like his most
Oh yeah,
accessible film, I
easily.
think. Like, if I'm going to introduce somebody to Tarkovsky, it's definitely going to be
My
Ivan's
first
Childhood.
Tarkovsky
That's
was
always my
Stalker because I thought
working.
the plot sounded cool. I was like, I'll watch this, and then I didn't know what I got myself into.
Stalker's grown on me a lot. Like, for a long time, it's like, oh, the two best Tarkovsky, it's always Andrei Rublev and Mirror. And now I kind of feel like Stalker's not quite there, but it's like, like it's almost there. Like it's kind of, like tier two, but Stalker takes up all of tier
I mean,
two.
it's
I
long enough to
don't.
take up all tier two.
Sure. It's also like when I watch a Tarkovsky film, it'll feel like, oh, clearly this is my favorite Tarkovsky film while I'm watching it. So it's really hard to sort of rank them and get
Also,
into them.
Ivan's Childhood is my second favorite World War II movie, so that's why I picked that one. So no one else would take it. My
Okay.
favorite World War II movie is Closely Watched Trains.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah,
That's
well,
a
I
great
haven't had an
film.
excuse to talk about that on
That's
any podcast yet. Slash
okay.
Production Booth did an episode on it a while ago with Sam Deegan. So it's kind of like, well, they kind of covered it better than I could.
I always feel like a little bit self-conscious talking about Czech films, like I'm gonna sound like it's just nepotism or something. I
I
don't
mean, I
know,
talk about
but
black films I
that's a
like a
really good film.
lot. We're gonna switch to Spike Lee soon-ish, so.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that too. Not that I don't love Kurosawa, but it's going to be cool getting into something
I
different.
suggested Spielberg initially, and then after I said to Joel, I immediately regretted saying that, and he said, "That's fucking boring," which is true.
It's tough to pick a filmmaker who's kind of got a good body of work. Like I was thinking of like on FlixWise. Next year, I might take a break from the regular format to do something that's more like a mini series, like maybe 5, 6 episodes about one filmmaker or theme. But it's really hard to sort of narrow in on something that could support that, but also feel like you could be comprehensive, but also, it's interesting and it's not like somebody's done it before. Like, I don't know, maybe, like, I thought John Huston might be kind of an interesting filmmaker to dive into, but I haven't decided yet.
So on that note, the next episode pairing is 1957 with Throne of Blood, which may have been recorded already. I'm not going to reveal the answer to that. And that episode will have Justin Harrison from the Ooh Tomorrow and His Five Women episode. And Justin Harrison writes for Birth, Movies, Death. He writes stuff about comics. He just did an essay thing on the Venom, the current Venom comic series. And it sounds so much better than a movie, and apparently is much better than a movie. But, Justin Harrison and Andrew Schwartz from the Talking About Turtle podcast, the podcast about the Entourage series that isn't about
the... Okay. I was going to say, don't tell them about the turtle in Tempopo.
No, it's started out as about every episode, but then it turned into something else because Entourage sucks.
I like that. Just ditch the premise of your podcast. Which more shows Schwartz would do that.
Andrew Schwartz is a real character. And it's Throne of Blood paired up with I always forget the name of it. It's Kobayashi from 57. Black River. I gotta look it up again. John Cribbs will be on.
I've got the Kobayashi book coming up and everything. I need to memorize my Kobayashi movies, but Kobayashi's great. He's a great filmmaker.
Anyway, John Cribbs will be on that episode with for Kobayashi. Yeah, okay, it is Black River. Okay, I did it right.
Okay.
So, yeah. And that's it. Cool. Hey, Martin, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me on. This was a lot of fun.
You're welcome. Too bad Joel was too busy going to Japan trying to find the perfect ramen recipe to be on. Yeah.
What he didn't know is that it was right under his nose the whole time.
I'll see you guys next time for Throne of Blood.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podiant. Thank you for listening.
South can of pork soda, you'll be feeling just fine. Ain't nothing quite like sitting around the house, swilling down them cans of wine.